to order. It is 2:05 p.m. Today is Friday, March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Parrish, Vice Chair Westlake, Representative Rauscher, Representative Drummond, and the co-chairs Josephson and Tarr. Today we are going to hear three pieces of legislation. And please let the record reflect before I tell you about the legislation that we have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Christy Blair. I appreciate everyone's willingness to move down the hall. Apparently, there's a water problem in the other room. We have our LIO moderator in the back. Today, we'll be hearing House Bill 19 first, and then we will be taking public testimony on House Bills 46 and 172, which we heard the previous day. And then following those three bills, we'll have presentations about some agricultural issues, including interior agricultural issues. So we'll start with House Bill 19, and if the sponsor and her staff will come forward. And you can place your names on the record and begin your presentation on House Bill 19, neonicotinoids.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Harriet Drummond, House District 18 in Anchorage. And no, we don't have farmers in that district, but we do have plenty of bees. One in three bites of food we eat relies on pollinators. Alaska's primary pollinators are native bumblebees. The diversity of native bees in Alaska is astonishing. About 4,000 different species have been cataloged in North America, and of those, 49 are found in Alaska. Bumblebees are the most prominent of those and are excellent pollinators, especially of Alaska's berry species. And we know how important berries are to so many thousands of Alaskans. More than 9 million European honeybees are imported into Alaska each year for honey production. These bees play a significant role in pollinating Alaska's crops and wild lands. Alaskan beekeepers are starting to overwinter bees in order to develop hardier Alaskan bee stock. Bee populations have been in an alarming decline since 2006 in many parts of the world. For the first time this year, a bumblebee species in the United States was declared endangered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Widespread use of a relatively new class of toxic pesticide, neonicotinoids, is a significant contributing factor. In addition to killing bees outright, research has shown that even low levels of neonicotinoids impair bees' ability to find their way back to the hive, collect food, produce new queens, and mount an effective immune response. This legislation would protect both agriculture and wild plants that rely on pollinators. The bill aims to prevent the spread of these pesticides before they impact Alaskan agriculture. Over two-thirds of the farmers involved with the Alaska Grown program grow crops that depend on bees for pollination. So in spirit of Co-Chair Tarr's third annual Food Security Week, we introduce this bill not only to protect Alaska's pollinators, but to protect Alaska's growing agricultural industry. I'll let my aide, Joanna Schultz, explain the difference between our original bill and the committee substitute and answer any questions you may have.
Hi. Right.
And before you begin, Ms. Schultz, we have a committee substitute.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion that we adopt the committee substitute. It's version 30-LS0219-D as the working document.
All right. I'll object for purposes of discussion. So, we have before us, for purposes of discussion, the CS, and it's Joanna or Joanne?
Joanna.
Joanna Schultz. If you will give us your name, you were about to do that, and then tell us the changes you've made between the bills.
Sure. So Joanna Schultz, for the record, Dr. Representative Drummond. The main difference between the CS and the original House Bill 19 is that the pesticides may be used in a greenhouse, and then they have to stay in a greenhouse. So the HB 19 allowed that it was only to be used in a greenhouse. CS requires that if they're used, they have to stay in a greenhouse for the remainder of their lifespan. The other thing I'd like to point out is that it exempts certified pesticide applicators. So those who are certified pesticide users can still use them outside a greenhouse or inside a greenhouse.
Before you take us through the bill, Ms. Schultz, when you say they have to stay in the greenhouse, do you mean?
The anything that the pesticides have been used on.
Okay.
So plants, it says here, seeds, foliage, or in granular form to soil. So anything the pesticide has been used on.
All right. Well, why don't you proceed with your presentation, if that's all the changes.
Sure. I don't actually have much of a presentation. I was just going to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Thank you. Through the chair. I was just wondering, we have heard that bees are now dying around the world for some reason, and I was wondering, is that happening, is it recordable that it's happening in Alaska at this time?
Representative Rauscher, that's a really good question. It's not happening in Alaska yet because the use of this neonicotinoid class of pesticides is not widely used. They're not widely used in Alaska right now. And our goal is to prevent the bees in Alaska, which are mostly wild pollinators, from being impacted by the use of this pesticide.
And to a follow-up? Sure. Thank you. Through the chair. Then I guess my concern is how do we track it? Is there an agency in Alaska that tracks it? Is there an agency in Alaska that I'm sure it's under the Department of Agriculture somewhere, but do we have a department within there that actually records or tracks future or past?
It's actually the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Tracks stuff like that. And Joanna, if you have
sure.
more details.
We should have a department. Joanna Schultz, for the record. We should have a Department of Environmental Conservation person online, hopefully, Christina Carpenter. And she can answer questions regarding that.
Ms. Carpenter, are you there? Let's start with that.
I am here.
All right. This is Chairman Josephson, and then there was a question from Representative Rauscher. Do you need to hear that question again?
Yes, please.
Sure.
Yes, thank you very much, and I appreciate you coming here to testify. Thank you through the chair. I was just wondering, the medium in the department that we use to track whether or not bees are affected or aren't affected or in the future in this state. In other words, if we start to, say we start to not use this chemical, is there a department medium that we utilize to count? I don't have any better word than that. Count the loss or the gain of bees here.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the department...
Ms. Carpenter, can you tell us who you are before you testify?
Yes, thank you so much. This is Christina Carpenter, and I am the division director for the Division of Environmental Health with the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, we are not directly tracking bee kill-offs in the state, but we do work with our counterparts in other states to track those bee kill-offs throughout the nation, and we work with our with the EPA as well.
Follow-up, Representative
Rauscher? I'm good. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yes, Vice Chair Wesley.
Thank you, and through the chair, Ms. Carpenter. Now, is there any unintended consequences you've seen in other states from using this particular pesticide?
Through the chair, I would be more than happy to provide you with some examples as a follow-up.
Through the chair, thank you.
So just to be clear, Vice Chair Westlake asked whether the pesticides listed cause harm, and you said you would follow up with some information. Is that what I just heard? So there, I'm sure there is some in the packet, but unless I'm wrong, that's what the record reflects there. Any other questions for Ms. Carpenter, since she is in an answering posture? Yes. If not, that's fine. I'll go back to the sponsor and her staff. Is there anything more that you'd like to tell us about the bill?
Nothing other than we need to stop the spread of this pesticide before it goes into widespread use in Alaska. That's the easiest time to take care of it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drummond, I have a question for you, and then Representative Parrish had a question. But the bill says that the use of the pesticides would have to be entirely within a greenhouse and stay there. Is the idea that I assume anything grown in the greenhouse would stay there. And is the idea that if a private person wants to take a risk with exposure, that's up to the individual? Is that sort of the thinking?
That sounds like the plan. When we refer to a greenhouse, it's usually a commercial greenhouse. It may or may not be true that plants, seedlings, are already coming up from the lower 48 that have been pre-treated with neonicotinoids. All the large stores, the home improvement stores, Fred Meyer, so on, sell thousands and thousands of seedlings that are not grown in Alaska, that are grown elsewhere, and that we have no control over how they've been treated, unless they come from a state that forbids the use of neonicotinoids. And they may not forbid it in a greenhouse where a lot of these seedlings may be started. So that's our goal, is to keep them from spreading in our state and getting a foothold. The small use that an individual might have in their own backyard may not be a big deal in the grand scheme of things, but I know I have bees that spend the summer in my backyard, and I would prefer not to expose them to neonicotinoids because they do a great job. They visit the whole neighborhood. I have neighbors telling me about the bees that come to their yards and pollinate their yards. It's a small thing, but many small things contribute to a much larger effort. And this is one of those that I think if we can literally nip it in the bud, we'd be smart to do so.
Representative Parrish, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question is, where else has this been done, this ban, and what have the effects been?
Through the chair, Joanna Schultz. Maryland is the only other state that this has been banned, and they are, I believe it was last year that it was passed by their legislature. Their bill is a little bit different, where it restricts sale, not so much usage, and they've basically put a two-year waiting period so that the products that were in Maryland could be sold and then no longer sold anymore there. In certain cities in the United States, it's also been passed. So I think Portland, Eugene, Spokane are a few examples.
Follow-up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And have there been any efforts internationally?
Yes. Also, the European Union, I believe it was 2013, they enacted a ban as well and are re-reviewing that either last year or this year.
Follow up.
Thank you. And have they seen any effects on the bee population since enacting that ban?
Through the chair, I have not seen any studies because I think it's actually in process now of finishing that, but that was the goal of the partial ban, so that they could really see if it made a difference.
Thank you.
Yeah. Before I forget and take other questions, my understanding is, for example, the state of Minnesota is sort of a cutting edge jurisdiction on banning some of these pesticides. But you mentioned Maryland. There must be other states, and I think Minnesota is one of them, that ban at least some classes of pesticides.
Yeah, through the chair, I also think Minnesota has been working on some legislation. I think Maryland is the only one that has passed legislation to ban the sale of neonicotinoids unless they are certified pesticide applicators.
Okay. All right. Representative Birch.
Thank you, sir. And I just had a question regarding the commercial availability of this product. And I apologize for being a little late. You may have covered that before, but if I walk into Walmart or Target or any of those stores where you find commercially available pesticides, is this something that you might pull off the shelf, or is it what's
absolutely. It's already available in the retail market. I don't know how professional applicators are using the product or if they're using the product. Our office contacted all of the growers in Alaska that we could locate, mm-hmm. and none of them are using this particular class of pesticides. But you or I can go down to Alaska Mill and Feed and buy a product that does include, among other kinds of pesticides, neonicotinoids.
Okay. Follow up. Yeah. So, are they identified by brand name, or do you have to look at that list of 200 things that's in the bottom of the label? I can't even say neonicotinoid. let alone try to find. Usually, it's got all the chemicals and.
This Representative Drummond through the chair, Representative Birch. There are a number of this class of neonicotinoids, and Joanna will be happy to pronounce them for you. My iPhone knows how to spell neonicotinoids. All I have to do is type in NEO, and it finishes it for me.
Okay. Well, I mean, it'd be nice to be, just commercially aware of what it is out there, because, we certainly don't want to be killing our bees off, but it'd be kind of nice to know as a consumer. I would think that that's a much more, the commercial guys are an important market, but they're professionals and know what they're doing. But the rest of us are just slopping around on a weekend and marching in to find something to kill bugs and be nice to know if there's a brand name or some way of.
Bayer is one of them. Until I learned about neonicotinoids, I didn't know that I had been applying them to my Siberian pea shrubs and birch trees for many years. It's kind of an expensive product for the my front yard of shrubs and trees. Mm-hmm. I used to apply them to kill off aphids. We have a big aphid problem in Anchorage and other areas from time to time. And I would buy this product in sufficient quantity to treat all of those particular shrubs and trees. And it was about $150 worth of product. That's about a gallon and a half. It's pretty expensive, right?
Yeah.
And I leave it in my garage or my greenhouse until I'm ready to apply it, until I see aphids. Well, one summer, it was August, before I realized, hey, that gallon and a half whatever product it's called is still sitting in my garage. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen any aphids. And I conferred with some other friends of mine who were gardeners, and they said, we have had very few. And the environment is actually changing to such a degree that there are way fewer aphid infestations. A lot of it has to do with how cold the winter is or how wet the weather is. But I won't use it unless I actually see aphids. The way these products are used, they're not supposed to be used when the plants are flowering. When plants are flowering is when bees are likely to be attracted to them. So if you use it when the bees are in the neighborhood and when they're flowering, that's the danger time for bees. But it says how to apply it on the label, of course. You can't count on everybody to follow the rules. However, the commercial applicators are the ones who are exempted from this ban because they are certificated because they're supposed to be following the rules and applying it at the appropriate time in the plant's growth.
Okay. Follow up, as much love as we're sharing for the bees, I'm always ready to smack down a wasp. Does the stuff that you use to wipe out the wasps, I mean, to obliterate them off the face of the earth? Does that damage the bees, or is that kind of a
Representative Birch? I'm not sure. Okay. I feel the
it's
same
not to
way,
make annoyed
but
stuff.
Wasps are actually there are some wasps in the pollinator class. The yellow jackets that we hate in our eaves of our houses in their big nasty nests. Mm. I don't know what product that is, but if you're just attacking the wasps, I can't imagine that it's going to impact flowers nearby.
Yep. Thank you.
Representative
Mr.
Thank you. Through the chair. Representative Drummond. Wasps and bees and bumblebees, are they all the same classification of insect, or are they different properties to withstand this neonicotinoid, I think it's it.
Representative Rauscher, Harriet Drummond through the chair. I don't know enough about them to tell you. I do know that the 49 pollinators that have been identified in Alaska include not only bees of various types, but wasps and a certain variety of flies that pollinate all kinds of plants. But I don't know enough entomology to be able to tell you the difference between them or what classes of insecta they are in.
Through the chair, they have a helpline here somewhere on the...
Well, Mr. Carter is here, and I think the question concerned whether a pesticide could be targeted for one species and not another. Is
whether this would just be targeted for, or whether it's going to affect them species-wide, I guess.
Right, and Mr. Carter, I don't know if this is your area of specialty, but lots of people talk sometimes, even when it isn't. But we want you to, of course, be comfortable with what you're saying. Is this something you can share?
Thank you, committee. Actually, I was here for 172, but yes, I can speak to this because agricultural producers around the world utilize, many different pesticides. So I think
You're Rob Carter for the record?
Oh, Rob Carter, Division of Ag.
Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, most of these, including neonics, are not selective. They will kill things.
So, through the chair again, a follow-up question. So, insects, is that it? All insects? Is that where we're headed?
I will not use the term all, through the chair. This is Rob Carter, Division Ag. Representative Rauscher. I don't like to use the word all. I will say that these do have a significant impact on a large majority of the insects out there, and that is their intention and that is their use and why they were created.
This may be through the final chair. Thank you. Mr. Carter, through the chair, I just want to know something now. If a person was using this for aphids, and it is my understanding that wasps eat aphids, because I believe that one time or a couple times in the history of Alaska we have dropped wasps to reduce the population of aphids. So if these are on the plant and the aphids are there and the wasp eats the aphid, what's the deal? Sorry, but my question.
This is Rob Carter. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, wasps and bees, I will answer that question for you guys. They are in the same kingdom, the same phylum, the same class. They're in a different suborder for everybody that remembers botany and biology in previous times. We have in the past in Alaska, there are parasitic wasps out there that do attack aphids. These type of chemicals also kill that aphid. So if in turn, I have not seen the research, so I can't speak to say that a parasitic wasp that attacks an aphid that is fed on a plant that has been treated with a neonic, if that would then carry over. The research may be out there, but I haven't seen it.
I appreciate you putting up with my questions. Thank you.
Vice Chair Westlake.
Yes, through the chair. So I'd like to follow up on that because I What concerns me, I'm applauding this bill. However, I'm really worried about unintended consequences. I mean, I remember the great tree blight when we had this terrific fire, and I mean that in the truest sense of a terrific fire that we had. And I'm looking at the chemical compositions in here. Is this going to impact other things that we can do to treat things along the highway would be my question. It is not having a bug that's out there killing trees and we can't do anything about it.
Sir, through the chair, Joanna Schultz. I want to point out that the CS does not ban certified applicators from using these neonicotinoids. So, people who are working to, you know, kill pests, insects along the road, generally are certified users.
Okay.
And it's the same with agriculture. So, if there is an outbreak of a certain pest, they should be able to use these as, you know, if they need to.
Thank you.
Yes, Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. As a botanist, it's hard for me to stay quiet here because this is something I've worked on for about 20 years. But I will say that the changes in the CS are very reasonable because most of the concern with application of these chemicals comes from individuals who are non-trained. And that's where, there's over-application, they're used in the wrong conditions. For example, if it's an outdoor application, you're supposed to use it under only certain conditions where there's not a lot of wind, things like that. And so, where these can be effective and can be used commercially, you know, when you limit it to the people who have had to go through the DEC classes and know all the specifications, you not only manage, improper application in the environment, but you also protect the worker health from any unnecessary exposure. So,
and I'll take the liberty of asking a question here. I'm certainly a fan of the bill, and I'm concerned about the health of our bee population in the United States. But I assume part of the linkage here is healthy ecosystems broadly, but also some economic interest in Alaska. And I don't. Can you connect that dot a little bit? About why bees are important in Alaska in that respect.
Mr. Co-Chair, Harriet Drummond, over two-thirds of the farmers involved with the Alaska Grown program they grow crops that depend on bees for pollination. And remember how I started my little conversation. One in three bites of food we eat relies on pollinators. And it doesn't matter where those come from. There are billions of bees that are bred and moved around in the world of agriculture to be there at the appropriate time for pollinating those particular crops. Okay. It's a huge industry in the lower 48.
All right. And let me segue and ask you about the fiscal note. And let me say that as one individual legislator, I'm not this idea that even in tough fiscal times, no legislation should ever cost anything is not something I subscribe to, but certainly some legislators will ask about the fiscal note. Is there something you want to share about it?
Mr. Co-Chair, through the chair, Harriet Drummond, I have having a hard time believing that the Department of Environmental Conservation needs one entire person to track a single pesticide when they're already tracking a number of other chemicals. It seems to me that could be added to the list that they accomplish, that they're already tracking. But it's hard for me to question the professionals in this matter.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Schultz,
can I also point out through the chair, Joanna Schultz here, that the fiscal note that you have in front of you is for the original House Bill 19 and not the CS, so it doesn't include the certified applicators piece.
Got it.
And that may and should lower the fiscal note.
That's helpful. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Parrish.
Oh, actually, I'd like to ask at some point, I could speak with you independently about this, whether or why you decided to go with the application rather than the sale of the products. I'd also like to point out briefly that studies have shown that these can also kill birds and potentially mammals and fish as well.
Did you want, Representative Parrish, did you want an answer to that right now?
At your convenience.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, I can speak to that.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Having worked on bills like this in the past, you cannot ban the sale because it violates the U.S. Constitution Interstate Commerce Clause. So we can't independently in the state of Alaska ban a sale that's otherwise able to be sold through through the proper registration with the United States government. And so what we can do is limit how those products can be used in our state.
Thank you.
And if you're really interested in this, I can't remember the name of the federal law, but there was just a change last year, bipartisan effort, fairly controversial about further restrictions on chemicals and that sort of thing. I'm not an expert in it, clearly. But Ms. Schultz, is there something more you wanted to add?
Sir, through the chair, Representative Parrish, are you referring to Maryland's?
Yes.
Okay. My understanding is that they have restricted where you can purchase these pesticides. So you can purchase neonicotinoid pesticides where you can also purchase restricted use pesticides. I'm not aware of any stores in Alaska that strictly sell restricted use pesticides. And this has gone through their legislation, you know, for a few years, and that's the best way that they found for their state. So
thank you.
I can provide their legislation later if you want.
Representative Rauscher.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I would like to make a statement, and I forgive me if I haven't. I think some of them are on Facebook comments, so I haven't been able to share them as far as being able to copy an email and pass it out to you all, but I have had a lot of comments in favor of this, and because I hadn't read it yet, I had not paid attention too much, but I do know there are a lot of beekeepers in Alaska who are concerned with this pesticide, but which is why I would like to know an awful lot about it before I vote, but water, runoff, rain, snow. I've seen it snow in July. How does that affect? I see here, I'm going to read something that I was given. Perhaps most alarming was the conclusion that a single kernel of corn coated with this neonicotinoid can kill a songbird when ingested, and then it goes on to say as little as one-tenth of a coated kernel seed per day during egg-laying season can impair reproduction, on and on. So I guess what I'm wondering is, when it rains, is it diluted any off of these plants? I know... I'm just going to speak from ignorance here, but, when I use my weed killer on my house, which you can buy in the store, I don't care whether you guys think I'm killing something, but I am killing my weeds. So, I use that, and it says an hour later, my dandelions are going to die still. Okay. So I'm wondering about the properties of neonicotinoid, whatever this is. Is this one of those things where it'll wash off the plant, or it stays with the plant an hour later? If you can understand what I'm doing, is this in the rain? Is it now contaminating the ground? I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it out. Are other plants laying on the ground? I'm trying to get a good feel for this.
Sure. Through the chair, Joanna Schultz here. Again, I am not an expert. I'm not a biologist, but mm-hmm. from my understanding, neonicotinoids are systemic, so that they're maybe Co-Chair Tarr could speak better to this, but basically how the bees are affected is the chemicals are in the pollen, so they go into the plant, and then they're kind of go through the plant and then are in the pollen. So the bees are pollinating and then being, impacted by that. Maybe Co-Chair Tarr should maybe answer that instead, but that's what I know.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, and by the way, for those who are really curious about this, the proper federal law to look at is FIFRA, Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide, which was not, I don't think, recently amended. It was TSCA, which was the Toxic Chemicals Act that was just amended. So unless there are any other questions, I think we'll go to public testimony. And first I'll ask if, I'll indicate that we've done that. We're in public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that wanted to testify on this? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go online first to David Otness in Cordova, if you're there, sir.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair and committee. Yeah, this is interesting, and I'm glad it's been brought to our attention. I semi-represent a loosely affiliated...
David, can you tell us your name, please?
And your affiliate. David Otness.
Okay. And for the record, it's O-T-N-E-S-S, David Otness of Cordova. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you very much. As I said, I'm glad to see this being brought up in a proactive sense. I think the onus should lie on the manufacturer of these chemicals to prove first that they are not harmful. I think that's something that's reasonable and practical in going ahead when there are so many questions about the lethality of neonicotinoids. And there have been numerous cases of massive die-offs that, that directly led to them being the source of this issue. It's a powerful poison. I believe it's derived from tobacco plants, and I think most of us understand how powerful tobacco is as a drug on its own. But before things get to the point where there could be conflicts of people wanting to use this on a commercial scale, I think it's excellent that we address it proactively right now and sort of take that attitude with much of what we're facing ahead of us here. And I think it would clarify a lot of things for the public and also those who might want to use it to begin with. I think that's about all I have. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Otness? I don't see any, so we will move on to the Anchorage LIO and Mr. Tazi.
Luigi Tazi.
Are you there, Mr. Tazi?
Where do I go? Right here? I am here.
All right. Can you give us your name, sir?
Sure. My name is Louis Tazi. I live at 2606 West 29th Avenue in Anchorage.
All right.
And first of all, thank you to the committee and to Representative Drummond. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, perfectly.
Okay, great. Thank you to the committee and to Representative Drummond for the opportunity to talk about this and about the bill. I sent an email to all of the committee members with what I hoped would be a fairly detailed set of comments. So I wanted to address a few things that I think are important. One of the questions that has come up so far is about the way that that neonics are damaging bees. The biggest issue with them is that these pesticides are systemic. They are applied in relatively low levels, and the plants pick them up and hold them in the body of the plant and all of the tissues of the plant, including the nectar and the pollen. And so basically it makes the plant itself a pesticide. So when an aphid comes and starts sucking on the plant delivers the pesticide to the aphid, and the aphid dies. Bees will gather nectar, and they have low levels of the pesticide in the nectar. They take it back to their colonies and make honey from that nectar, and in the process of making honey, they evaporate out the water in the nectar, so it has the effect of making it very concentrated. And because these are they're systemic and they're also very long-lived, they're intended to last in the plant for the entire life of the plant. So while applying them when the plant is blooming is an issue, it could have been applied much sooner than that, and it still presents an impact to honeybees. Another issue that has not been addressed so far is that there is an issue in the language regarding the regarding where it says applying to the soil in granular form. This is potentially a big problem because it creates a loophole where a farmer who purchases treated seed or a greenhouse person who purchases treated seed from outside of Alaska could potentially plant that seed outdoors because the legislation specifically states only in granular form. So it wouldn't prevent somebody from applying, for example, a liquid or a seed with a treatment on it. Another possible issue is that when applying these chemicals, they often will drift out as a dry residue, and it will drift into areas that are not a part of the farm field, and they are readily picked up by the indigenous plants in and around. And so even though the pesticide was applied as a coating to a seed in a field, the dust from planting it spreads out over the adjacent countryside, and all of the adjacent plants are now also dosed with the pesticide. I could go on and on, but I'll refer you to the email that I sent, and I'm happy to answer any questions or offer clarifications in email.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Tozzi? Yes, Representative Rauscher.
Yeah. Now, this is Mr. Otness?
Yes. No, it's no. Mr. Tozzi, T-O-Z-Z-I.
Tozzi. Okay. I apologize. Through the chair, Mr. Tozzi, your credentials on this topic.
I am a beekeeper. I am part of a group of beekeepers who are, I'm sorry?
You've got the floor. Go ahead. Okay. You're part of a group of beekeepers,
I'm
you
said. Part of a group of beekeepers who are working to breed an Alaska hardy bee so that beekeeping in Alaska can be more sustainable. Bees do overwinter here in Alaska, but it requires a tremendous amount of intervention on the part of the beekeeper, and so we're trying to develop bees that are more sustainable in Alaska. And so I don't have a scientific background other than what I need to know as a beekeeper.
Follow up, Representative Rauscher.
If it is.
Yes. Where it is. The record, and there's been a request that Ms. Carpenter take up to the extent she can recall some of the things that Mr. Tozzi said. And okay, and the one that was most interesting to me was his comment that I hope Representative Drummond took note of, that treated seeds could be placed outside and avoid the prohibition on treatment to in a granular form. Treated or liquid seeds was the essence of it. But Representative Rauscher.
Yes. I had heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, the gentleman who actually made the statement, once applied to the plant, it becomes part of the plant because it's systemic. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, are there other insecticides that do this also? And then the follow-up question would be, the statement was made that once they, whatever becomes from this plant, a flower and the bee touches it and brings it back to the hive, and then it part of the honey. Is that true of other pesticides? If someone can answer that.
Ms. Carpenter, did you hear that question? You've been nominated as the person to answer.
Yes, this is Christina Carpenter. I can follow up and provide some information.
That's fair. Okay.
If that would be acceptable.
Yes, I'm told that it is.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Chair.
All right. Question for from Representative Birch for Mr. Tozzi or Ms. Carpenter, I suppose.
For Mr. Tozzi through the chair. First of all, I want to thank you for your informative and helpful email message yesterday. One question I did have on having lived in Fairbanks for about 25 years, I had a number of friends that were beekeepers up there, and they could overwinter their beehives, as I recall, but the challenge was keeping them fed all winter. But I'm thrilled with your efforts and initiative, and curious as to, you know, we're talking about pesticides here. So are the bees more resistant to one pesticide or another, or is it the fact that the pesticide that this neonic represent that those have longer staying power? In other words, they stay in the body of the bee, and I'm a little fuzzy on that because it seems like a pesticide of any name would be bad for bees. Any way you cut it.
The answer to the question is the with neonicotinoids.
Mr. Tozzi, can you re-indicate that it's indeed you speaking to the committee?
Louis Tozzi, responding to Representative Birch's question. The issue is that the pesticides are very long lived. So a colony of bees would encounter nectar and pollen with this pesticide at some point early in the year, in the summer, take those resources back to their hive, turn them into honey, and store it. And that pesticide will remain in an active form throughout the winter. The problem that bees have with it is that while it may be that at the levels they're encountering it at the flower is not toxic, when they return it back to the hive and make honey from it, they're concentrating it because they're evaporating out the water, and then they use that honey throughout the winter and provide a constant low-level exposure to that pesticide through the winter. There is a fair amount of evidence that a lot of the bee deaths that are occurring in the lower 48 over the winter is related to bees just disappearing in the middle of the winter. And the thought is that this is a neurotoxin, and the bees just sort of lose track of where they're supposed to be and what they're supposed to be doing, and then fly off in the middle of winter. Anecdotally, I've heard of a case or two of that here, but I can't tell you that that's what the cause was. The problem with this pesticide, or this class of pesticides, is that it's stored in the hive, also in the wax, which is an important economic thing because clean beeswax is something that's very difficult to come by. But it's stored in the honey and provides an ongoing low-level exposure to the colonies, which makes it much less likely for them to survive the winter.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We're now going to move to Ms. Patty Saunders of the Alaska Community on Toxics. Alaska Community Action, I think is what it's called. Ms. Saunders, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. If you'll identify who you are, I know you think you just did that, but we have this process. So if you'll tell us who you are, we'll give you a chance to testify about the bill.
Thank you. My name is Patty Saunders, Development Director at Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Thank you to the co-chairs and committee members for having this hearing. Our biologist and executive director, Pamela Miller, is unfortunately traveling this week and sends her apologies for not being able to be here today to testify in support of this bill. Alaska Community Action on Toxics is a statewide nonprofit environmental health research and advocacy organization. We want to thank Representative Drummond for introducing HB 19. We strongly endorse this bill as an important measure to protect bees and other pollinators so crucial to the majority of Alaskan and American food crops. Neonicotinoid pesticides have long been associated with harm to bees and other pollinators. In 2016, the EPA released its first risk assessment of neonicotinoid pesticides and concluded that they can cause significant harm to honeybees. Numerous independent peer-reviewed scientific studies have demonstrated that the widespread use of this dangerous class of pesticides is a factor in the precipitous decline of bees and other pollinators in recent years. These scientific studies have shown serious adverse effects to bees' navigational ability, mobility, and reproduction. Even small amounts of exposure can damage the bees' ability to collect pollen, impair their memory and social behavior, weaken their immune systems, and harm colony health and longevity. Scientists have shown that exposure to certain neonicotinoid pesticides reduces bees' immune systems, promoting infections associated with diseases such as deformed wing virus. Recent environmental studies have shown that chronic exposures of honeybees to environmental levels of neonicotinoid pesticides impairs their learning and memory. Another study reported that wild bees who are exposed to neonicotinoid-coated seeds had reduced nesting and were not successful in building brood cells for new larvae. In addition, chronic exposure to imidacloprid, one of the most commonly used neonics, was found to be associated with reduced brood production, reduced colony growth, and an 85% reduction in the production of bumblebee queens. Neonicotinoid pesticides also have adverse effects on other non-target and beneficial organisms, such as butterflies, birds, and aquatic insects. And there are emerging concerns about the possible adverse neurodevelopmental effects of neonics on children. That would include impaired brain development, irreversible among children. We believe the evidence supports the need for urgent legislative action. We urge swift passage of HB 19 to suspend the use of these harmful chemicals in Alaska.
Thank you, Ms. Saunders. Any questions for Ms. Saunders from committee members? Representative Birch has a question for you, Ms. Saunders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've talked about the commercial availability of these products. If I walk into a Home Depot or someplace where you go to buy pesticides hot summer day, and if I'm looking at the shelf full of pesticides, did the neonics represent like half of them, or are they just onesie twosies, or how widespread are these? If you're trying to constrain the use or distribution, how widespread are these pesticides?
Well, they're very commonly available. I cannot give you a precise percentage. I haven't done that market research. I'm sure we could do it, but we haven't yet. The problem is that people, just reading the label isn't necessarily going to help people, because this class of pesticides is not labeled as a class. You would have a specific name. For instance, imidacloprid. If you don't know that that's a neonic, you won't know that that's not something that is killing bees. So there's going to have to be some education, both of the sellers and of the consumers, around this. But I think that's the least of our concerns. I think that's easily done. I think there is already a lot of concern among Alaskans about neonics and their effect on bees, and I think they would welcome more information about these endocrine-disrupting pesticides.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Ms. Saunders? Seeing and hearing none, what I'm going to do is, first, I had an objection to version D, which is before us for purposes of discussion. I'd like to lift that objection. Is there any other objection to committee substitute being the bill before us? I don't see any, so version D will be before us. I'm going to close public testimony as to HB 19, and I'm going to set this bill aside until it's brought up either as bills previously heard or under regular calendar. I'm going to turn the gavel over to my co-chair.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. And Representative Josephson's going to have to leave us here in a couple of minutes because the Labor and Commerce Committee is meeting. And so we'll set this bill aside. But this was supposed to be Agriculture Week in our Resources Committee, and, of course, our schedule was we had the important work of dealing with the operating budget this week. So I'm excited to come back to some items I'd hoped that we would get to this week. With House Bill 46, we're going to complete, do the public testimony on that, and then go to public testimony on House Bill 172, and then we have two presentations. So we're going to marathon through this here at the end. So going back to House Bill 46, this was the promotion of the Alaska Grown and the Alaska Product Preference Statute. We're going to go ahead and open public testimony. We have two individuals online to testify, and we do have Director Keyes in the room, although he was with us the other day, so we'll go to the ones on the line first and see if there's anything additional to add. We're on the off nets. We've got John Anderson. Is Mr. Anderson available?
Yes, Ms. Vice Chair. For the record, John Anderson from Fairbanks.
Please give us your testimony.
Okay. Well, I would first like to thank the committee and also the subcommittee for resources in regards to their interest and their attention to act. It's been well needed, and it's been a very good breath of fresh air, first of all. So thank you very much for that. So my testimony today is I listened to the House Resource Committee, and I had a few concerns about House Bill 46. First off, I would like to say that I am a livestock producer in the state, and House Bill 46 is a good attempt at a futile process that someone like myself can't touch. The bill will only help large producers, first and foremost. While there might be a small trickle-down effect, in reality, it just benefits a few farmers, and I won't say their names, but as a small livestock producer, I can never touch the price point that is anywhere close to the 15%, unfortunately. There is also an issue of what will be considered Alaska grown. On the livestock side, there has been a recent surge in import animals that are currently being marketed as local animals. Will these animals be allowed to come into the state and slaughter the next day and market it at that 15% increase, or will the Alaska grown standard be held to the high standard it was implemented with, which is 51% of its life? If imported animals are allowed to be considered to this standard without any checks, then certain producers will take advantage of bottom floor cattle and hog prices, especially in Canada right now, and walk away making lots of quick bucks and having an almost zero impact in our state. They won't be buying Alaska grain or hay in any substantial numbers. So what good is this program if people can take advantage and if the Division of Ag doesn't use the safeguards they already have in place? I would also like to caution you on the belief that the Alaska Grown logo is thriving. While yes, the program has grown, and I am also a member, I also see a lot of instances of complete disregard of what the logo stands for and the intentional mislabeling of products. I brought many of these concerns to the Division of Agriculture, and they do not feel they can protect the logo anymore. It is disheartening to hear this from them, but at this point, places across the state are looking for new marketing ideas. In the interior, we are lucky to have a new logo called Golden Heart Grown, in Palmer, Grow Palmer, just to name a few. This is just moving away from Alaska Grown because of the fear and facts that has been diminished, and the division will not investigate wrongdoings anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I appreciate your testimony. And as the bill sponsor, let me just address a couple of the comments you made. Right now, the existing statute is only 7%. And so if the 15% wouldn't allow an opportunity for you, the existing statute certainly wouldn't allow an opportunity because it's actually more than 50% less. So this is a big improvement from existing statute, and I understand it will not accommodate everyone, and I am right there with you about the challenges of being a small producer, whether it be vegetables or livestock, because there's the economies of scale challenge. And, one of our sort of commitments to doing this is that, you know, this is one of the opportunities that we can consider, but certainly not the only one. And we will continue working to support, you know, things that will allow more opportunities for a small producer like yourself. So that I want to make that known that this, while you don't, you know, feel that this might help you personally, certainly it won't be the only effort you'll see from this committee to support our agriculture industry. And there's a lot of opportunity in livestock. That's what one of the reasons I was such a big proponent of the Mount McKinley meat factory plant processing facility and making sure that, you know, something could happen with that so that folks like yourself do have opportunities and abilities to get into the market. On the Alaska Grown, we would anticipate using the same Alaska Grown rule and standard that's in place now. And so I think that concern can be alleviated, although I'm aware of the concern that you raised about imported animals. So I hope those can address your concerns, and I hope you'll stay in touch and would really appreciate if you wanted to send an email so I'd have your contact information so I can keep you in the loop as we continue other opportunities. Representative Rauscher has a question for you.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I was just wanting to get a – you're from Fairbanks?
Through the vice chair, Representative Rauscher, that's correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Anderson. We appreciate you calling in today. We're going to now go to Mr. Otness in Cordova.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair and Committee. This is David Otness speaking on behalf of myself right now. I've decided to withhold testimony pending a deeper look at this. I like the sentiment behind it and want to see our state develop more interstate commerce or intrastate commerce, and I like that part of it, but I do need to get up to speed on this. Thank you very much.
Okay, we thank you, Mr. Otness. Those are the only two individuals online. Ms. Heron from the Division of Agriculture is online, I think, for questions. But Ms. Heron, did you want to add anything to the conversation?
No, I appreciate the. Sorry, this is Johanna Heron for the record with the Division of Agriculture, Department of Natural Resources. Through the chair, I just appreciate the opportunity for the dialogue and the conversation, and I'm definitely listening and taking down feedback from the public, and I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Were there any questions for Ms. Heron? Representative Parrish.
The first testifier suggested that animals can be imported one day, slaughtered the next, and then marketed as Alaskan grown. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I appreciate that question. That is not currently the practice. The certification policy that was passed in previous years states clearly on there that livestock must be raised 51% of its life or more in the state to be marketed as Alaska grown. There have been a couple instances where that has been challenged and concerns have been raised, and we investigate as we hear of those.
Thank you.
And Ms. Heron, could you please state your name again for the record?
I apologize. Johanna Heron with the Division of Agriculture. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Heron? Is there anyone in the room that wanted to testify on this? Okay, then I'm going to close public testimony. And is there any committee discussion on this matter? Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I'm just going to start off with first, what is your intention with this bill today?
Representative Rauscher, we'd like to move this bill today.
I figured that. So I'm going to put in a request that we have been concentrating very heavily on the floor since we heard this bill, and I have not been able to give anybody concerned that this bill will concern due diligence. And my district is a very big farming district, as you know. It has, it touches both Palmer, all points in between to Glen Allen and on down to Valdez and up to Delta. you know, I just want to make sure that we were able to, at least I was able to. I think that's a very big chunk of farmland there and agricultural land and livestock. I mean, the list goes on. I'm just going to request to hold it an extra day or so I could talk to some of these farmers. I apologize.
Representative Rauscher, I don't mind that at all. We do have some extra meetings scheduled this week. The unfortunate backup, you know, sort of now we're several days behind. So we have Monday evening and Wednesday evening meetings scheduled for next week. And so to get caught up and make sure that we can get through the bills, you know, then I think what it'll require is to have those evening meetings so we can get caught up on the things that were supposed to happen this week. So we don't get too far behind. And so I'm fine with honoring that request. What I can tell you is this particular product preference statute I've been working on since 2014 and have presented at two, three Farm Bureau meetings now with many of the individuals that you represent and have worked very closely with those individuals like Mr. Wrigley in promoting this and have had quite a bit of support. But I don't want you to, you know, feel like you've been rushed and didn't get to talk to the people you need. So I'm happy to hold it if that's what you'd request.
And I appreciate that through the chair. I by no means do I want to step on your opinion, any of your work, any of the due diligence you've given it, any of the beliefs that Mr. Keyes, has, Director Keyes, has done, or the esteem that I hold for Bryce Wrigley. So, but I would like to be able to look into this just a little bit. I appreciate it.
Okay. No problem. Representative Wesley.
No, thank you, and through the chair. Representative Rauscher there. Now, I'm unfamiliar with the Department of Ag. Is there are they geographic slots? Like, can he have someone that's in his house district that he can talk to over there from Department of Ag?
Representative Westlake, the Division of Ag, our director is here, but unfortunately, in fact, one of the reasons I am so supportive of this is the second piece of the bill is there's not a lot of staff. Most of them are in the Palmer area. However, I know they're very familiar with the agricultural operations because they work with the farmers every day. And so, you know, I hope either through the director or through the division staff, you'll be able to get your questions answered or your constituents. And so at this time, what I think we'll do, just because we have one other bill, public testimony, and then these two presentations, is we'll just agree, we'll set this bill aside, but it'll come back up on Monday. And so if I could make the request of you, Representative Rauscher, let me know, you know, ASAP, if you have any other issues, that would be helpful. And then I'd love to work together to resolve any.
And I will work on it this weekend.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay, then we'll go ahead and set HB 46 aside, and then we'll go on to HB 172 for public testimony. And we have a few individuals online here. So we'll go to David Otness first in Cordova.
Good afternoon, Chair Tarr and committee members. I'm really happy to see this one having come up. I testified for it in Senate Judiciary a while back. I think it's important that we expand into a hardy crop that has so many applications and none of the negatives formerly associated with it. Alaska's got a good potential for those of us who remain here through the thick and thin, and the thin that we're about to endure, as a matter of fact. This should give people a good means of supplementing their existing operations and perhaps incentivize others to start up. It seems to have essentially unlimited potential and a hardy enough plant for Alaska. And with our daylight hours, it should just thrive. So I just heartily endorse the idea of our agriculture expanding in this direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Otness. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Otness? Okay, seeing no questions, we will go to Jack Bennett from Homer. Mr. Bennett, are you available?
Good afternoon, through the chair. I'm Jack Bennett, originally from Fairbanks, Alaska. representing Industrial Hemp Manufacturing, LLC. Industrial hemp, it's not a marijuana issue, but it's an agricultural one. And I encourage you to rethink the way we think about hemp. The machinery, my company, it's North America's largest. It has the capability of producing 40 million pounds annually, and it's devoted to the oil well companies to help Alaskan fluids engineers drill faster, lighter, and cheaper. All of our fiber is sold out to the automotive partner in the state of Indiana that will manufacture American automobiles with biocomposites, hemp plastics, stronger than fiberglass on a boat, more flexible than a Formula One race car. It's also, I presented it to various military throughout Alaska as a remediation product that replaces polypropylene booms in the water, 5 times more absorbent, and they don't go to the landfill. They're turned into an energy source. And that remediation product through these plant fiber technologies are also used, are applied in the soil in the granular form to remediate land impacted by crude, chemicals, radiation, what have you, within 90 days. I'm building a model home in Homer, Alaska to present as a solution to affordable housing. There's 6,000 unit shortages in rural Alaska. The data is 22,000 acres in one season produce 1,000 square foot homes. I appreciate you letting me share, and this it doesn't matter how green it is. At the end of the day, we're all here to make money.
Thank you, Mr. Senator. We really appreciate your testimony. Representative Rauscher has a question.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Through the chair, Mr. Bennett. Mm-hmm. You are Industrial Hemp Manufacturing, LLC.
Correct. iHempMan.com.
And you are located in Homer.
I'm the representative for Alaska for Industrial Hemp Manufacturing LLC. That equipment is a $30 million piece of technology on steroids. There's only 5 on the planet like it. 2 in France, 2 in South Carolina, or 2 in South Africa, and 1 in North Carolina. And we will work to bring up state-of-the-art decorticator in Alaska to work with the farmers to collect the material devoted to remediation in oil and gas industries in Alaska, because the price of oil, it's not going to remain at $42.50 anymore. The smokestacks are coming back, and iHempMan.com certainly wants
Mr.
to be...
Mr. Bennett, I appreciate that. Are you located in Anchorage right now, or through the chair, or are you outside?
Sir, I'm located at the LIU in Homer.
Okay. Where do you get your hemp from now to be a hemp manufacturer incorporated?
Uh-huh. That's a great question. North Carolina is currently shaping their regs and policies. We need 7,000 acres of industrial hemp to produce 40 million pounds annually. My counterparts, we're looking at purchasing 14,000 acres because the machinery has the ability to expand to 80 million pounds. So we're using hemp's cousin, KNAF, K-E-N-A-F, a member of the hibiscus family. U.S. Navy has done case studies on it as being the most absorbent natural plant on Earth, used as a remediation product, and hemp is more absorbent than KNAF. So as an alternative, we're using KNAF. I hope that answers your question.
Through the chair.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up?
Where are you getting KNAF?
It's growing in what's called the tobacco belt in the Georgia, North Carolina region.
Okay, and through the chair, do we have any regulations on KNAF right now? What is at all? To Mr. Bennett?
Mr. Bennett?
KNAF is a legal agricultural crop. The fibers used in the automotive industry to manufacture automotive parts. All of the fibers totally sold out. The automotive industry will take it all. So the companies in transition are transitioning out of canap into industrial hemp because industrial hemp has more value-added products.
Representative Rauscher?
I appreciate it very much, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Bennett? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. It seems like you've implied that your organization is prepared to make a substantial commitment or a substantial investment in Alaska. Is that accurate, and about what dollar amount are we talking?
I've presented to many oil well drilling companies in Alaska. This is an emerging technology that helps the fluids engineer, and this is what they'll use from now on. That industry alone, that mud additive, is a billion-dollar industry annually.
Follow-up, Representative Parrish?
You mentioned earlier you were thinking of bringing a plant to Alaska. What would that entail? And if this were law tomorrow by some magic of government, how quickly could we expect to see more substantive investment from your organization?
Through the chair, baby steps. Legislation has to pass, and we will work. We will help you to bring up a decorticator, not the $30 million one, but a one that is affordable. A lot of R&D has been put into it, that will be mobile to go in a centralized location, so it will be accessible to farmers to utilize for their specific crop, what specific industry that they're growing it for.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Any other questions for Mr. Bennett? Thank you, Mr. Bennett. It's been really informative. Appreciate you being online today. Next, we're going to go to Wes Schott with the Alaska Cannabis Advocacy.
Hello.
Hello. Please state your name for the record, and then we'd love to hear your testimony.
Okay. My name is Wes Schott from Fritz Creek, Alaska. And, hemp has been in American agriculture since, even before the inception of America. Both sides of my family's ancestry raised it. And it's also helped the American economy off and on for years. The Revolutionary War, Civil War, it was required by every farmer over 5 acres of land to raise 1 acre of industrial hemp. And to outlaw it and not have its production is ludicrous. And also, hemp is great for soil erosion. There's many uses for it, everything from soil erosion to plant fiber for building materials, oil for everything from edible oil to bird seed. And I urge everybody to read the HB 172 industrial hemp pamphlet that gives some general information on the product. And I find it really a name that we're allowed to grow psychoactive cannabis, but not industrial hemp. You can smoke old hemp you want, and you're going to get a headache or sore lungs. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate your testimony and sharing your cool family history. I think one of the fun things and why we've been saying there's an agriculture renaissance is when you look at that history, the Victory Gardens, the what you mentioned about growing the industrial hemp. Historically, you know, this is agriculture's played such an important role in our country and, you know, in our security. And it's really fun to hear those kind of stories and think we're getting back to some of those roots. No pun intended.
Thank you.
And Mr. Carter's on the line. Mr. Carter, did you have anything else you'd like to add today?
Madam Chair, no, I was strictly here for questions for either the bill sponsor or for the committee or to help try to maybe clarify general public's questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carter. Are there any questions for Mr. Carter from the Plant Materials Center, the Division of Ag? Okay, then what we're going to go ahead and do is we're going to also close public testimony on this bill, and we're going to set this bill aside, and we'll probably bring it back up on Monday. The same thing in the evening meeting with the other agriculture bill, and hopefully the weekend will give everybody a chance to check in with folks, and you can do a two-for-one, Representative Rauscher, and check in with folks and get feedback on both of those.
Madam Chair, can I ask the director a question? He might be able to provide us more information for our next meeting.
Yes, of course.
I ask him a question.
Well, he's going to be coming up to the seat as part of the next presentation anyhow. So, Director Keyes, if you want to come join us at the table, and we'll do that question, and then we'll transition into the rest of the presentation. We have two other items that will be very exciting to talk about before we finish today. So please provide your question to Representative Rauscher.
I'm going to preface my, through the chair, I'm going to preface my statement or question as a person who's not against this bill, okay? And I don't really care what your answer is, okay? But I'm just curious that in the discussion we had earlier, it said, and it won't change my vote one way or the other, but the Division of Ag will draw the regulations. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher.
Getting really good at identifying ourselves.
this is Arthur Keyes, the Director of Agriculture. I think Rob.
Did you identify?
Yes. He did.
I did. This is Arthur Keyes, Director of Agriculture.
Right.
So Rob Carter, actually, I think could speak to this. What our intention was with the regs. Rob, are you still on the line?
Director Keyes, yes, I am.
Could you take this question, please?
This is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag Plant Materials Center, for the record. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, with this industrial hemp production bill, it is to us and our intent through the sponsor that the regulations would be have to be drafted to provide a sustainability for what could be a future of growth in the agricultural industry regarding industrial hemp, and it is our intent to draft those regulations so that we then fall within the guidelines of the legislation itself, and then to do what we can best to make this a sustainable program for those interested all around the state of Alaska, as simple as possible, to make sure that, you know, because of its association, it's guilty by association to recreational marijuana, that we want to make sure that, you know, we have a good foundation to support this industry, provide this industrial hemp program, and then move forward and let the industry grow.
And a follow-up?
And a follow-up. Thank you, through the chair. So then I notice that I have three fiscal notes that all say zero. And I'm just wondering that if we're actually, you know, I have another bill, and I believe the DNR is not going to be a part of actually writing it, so to speak, as much as being a part of approving it and letting us in our community work it out and then work with it in conjunction to what they will allow us all. But this bill, if we're working on regulations from the scratch, I'm just wondering, we're separating it, we're dissecting it from one branch, and we're moving it to the care of the Department of Ag, who is going to write the regulations, and I'm just wondering, the fiscal note.
And just quickly, remember, Division of Ag is under the Department of Natural Resources. And it sounds like, Mr. Carter, I don't know if you want to comment on this, and then it sounds like the sponsor staff has a comment as well. Did you want to add anything, Mr. Carter?
I would like to follow up as soon as the bill sponsor gets done.
Okay. Please state your name for the record, and then.
My name is Patrick Fitzgerald. I'm staff to Representative Drummond.
through the chair to Representative Rauscher, that actually on one of the fiscal notes it stipulates, it says this legislation regulates the cultivation and possession of industrial hemp within the Department of Environmental Conservation. That was actually pointed out to me by a member of this committee's office, and we actually have talked to the writer of the fiscal note, which was the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, and they actually had made a mistake with that, which is being corrected. And the new fiscal note will still read all zeros, but it will illustrate that the regulations will be under the Division of Agriculture. I hope that clears up your question.
Well, I'll let the gentleman on the phone have a crack at it. Thank okay. you. No, you did good. Don't think you can be wrong. I just think we're looking for something else here.
And Representative Rauscher, are you trying to understand that, you know, the fact that there's a zero fiscal note, but sort of whose responsibility is it going to be? Because I think that, and maybe Mr. Carter can speak to this, you know, with existing staff, this would be a part of their responsibility. And so, you know, it wouldn't require any additional staffing to draft regulations. And I think that's why you see the zero fiscal note. And I think, is that what you're getting at?
Through the chair, if you would sit with me in finance when they discuss my HB6, I would appreciate it, and I am not going to argue you one second after that. Thank you.
Mr. Carter, do you have anything you want to add to that? And I think that gets at the heart of it. It's sort of, you know, to the extent you would be involved in drafting those regulations, this is something you would do within the existing scope of work and, you know, within your, you know, regular full-time work at the Division of Ag.
Madam Chair, wonderfully said. I will not, I will follow Representative Rauscher's suit there and not add too much more, but, you know, from the division standpoint, from the plant material standpoint, once a crop has been deemed agricultural, it falls into the purview of the Division of Ag. And us being the content experts on plant production, you know, within the state system, at least this portion of it, there's, of course, folks at the university, we feel that it's our responsibility to support agricultural industries all, and if this legislation does pass, that does put it in our purview.
Okay. We're good with you. Representative Parrish, and then we do have one additional testifier who's come online.
We've just got one quick, I guess it would be a conceptual amendment. Look at this. The department shall annually review each fee level to determine whether the regulatory cost of industrial hemp is approximately equal to the fees collected. They're also targeted to be at that level. On the next page, top of page 3, there's the industrial hemp pilot program. The department or an institution of higher ed in the state may create and administer an agricultural pilot program to study growth, cultivation, and marketing of industrial hemp. It just seems to me like it might be a useful allocation of funds to set the fee schedule in such a way as to be able to finance some sort of pilot program so that we could be doing research as we're charging forward.
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair to Representative Parrish, that's the idea of the pilot program.
Mr. Fitzgerald, that it would be self-funded through the fees.
The fees would produce the funds in order to conduct the studies through it.
And a follow-up?
I don't see where that's permitted in the language, because it's the regulatory costs for regulating the industry. It doesn't make allowances for allocations to the industrial hemp pilot program that I can see anyways. I may be wrong.
Pastor Fitzgerald, through the chair to Representative Parrish, I will take a look at the Section 7606 of the Farm Bill, and I will follow up with that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on that? Let's go to this last individual. I'm going to reopen public testimony since we've had someone join in. We have George Pierce from Kisilov online. Mr. Pierce, are you available?
Yes, ma'am. I really appreciate you opening the testimony again for me. A couple things. My name's George Pierce. I'm representing me and my neighbors, and I live in Kisilov, Alaska. Write this down for yourselves. It's called the Information Distillery. It's a website online. You can go and read all about how good hemp is. It's It's not like marijuana. You're not going to get high on it. But here are some statistics here. It's been, hemp is one of the most useful plants on earth. It enriches the soil when it's grown. It has food and nutritional value. Hemp seeds are an excellent source of protein, minerals, and dietary fiber. Hemp is the only plant that contains all of the essential fatty acids and amino acids required for the human body. You know, this is a very good thing. There's so many things to say good about it. I'm not going to have time, but many people eat fish and take fish oil supplements to get the essential fats. However, concerns around overfishing and chemical contaminants, the modern fish have made many choices to switch to hemp instead because of its nutritional value. It's good for animals, for birds, as somebody said a little bit ago. Do you realize it's good for body care, paper? The first American flag was made out of hemp. It's good for fiber, textile, rope, petroleum. It will replace gasoline for diesel engines. I mean, it's amazing what this product will do. So please do all of us a favor and yourselves and go in and look at this website. And after you look, there's several links that tell you more and more and more about what this product will do. And it's not going to harm anybody. It's not going to hurt anybody. It's essential, and it is a renewable resource, and it's a source of income. You know, so we need some resources to come in now and produce money, and this is a great thing. And please, don't compare it to marijuana because it's not. So thanks for taking my testimony, and please look this up, the Information Distillery. And Mr. Parrish, I'm sure you, being a newcomer, and Representative Tarr, you also, you will, I'm sure, take the time out and look at this information, and at least you'll know how it's being done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce. The botanist in me is very happy with all your comments and very familiar with all the positive uses and now feeling even patriotic with the mention of the American flag. Thank you for your testimony today. Any questions for Mr. Pierce? Okay, then we're going to go on to Ed Martin. One other individual has joined us. Mr. Martin, are you available?
Yes, ma'am, I am. This is Ed Martin, Jr. I'm 62 years old, lived in the state of Alaska since 1965. I'm second generation from statehood and two generations past me. We currently own some property in Sterling, Alaska, for which would be available for both marijuana and for hemp. Although, and may I point it out to you folks, my wife and I are not allowed to get a license in the state of Alaska, although we've been residents for that many years, to grow or sell because we're not a permanent fund dividend applicant. I would surely hope when you pass this bill, there will not be a requirement for a protection racket in the industry to just Alaskans. I understand that this is a revenue getter, and I pleaded with the legislature to go through their administrative regulation review to look at the regulations on the marijuana law. But there is a distinction between the two. And both of them are revenue getters for the state of Alaska. I sat through a House Finance Committee or House floor today and watched many bills to cut state spending. And it appears that your caucus of 21 is doing their job. I'm not very proud of that, folks. And I'm going to tell you right now that this is a revenue getter along with selling Alaska's land so we could have larger farms that will produce this product and will create revenue for the state and jobs. I wish you folks would quit looking at how you can sustain government and not create revenue other than getting into the permanent fund and changing it and or look at revenues that could be bought from the sale of Alaska's land resource. We're going to need more agricultural land. if this becomes an industry as big as it should be. I implore you folks, many of you sat there today and voted against cutting government. Well, be responsible and create an industry that will create revenue for the state. So I'm 100% supportive of this hemp cultivation project. I implore that you don't put the standard so high that people like my wife and I that spend half the year in Hawaii, and believe me, the reason we live here is because we're over 60. And, you know, my doctor tells me, I can't shovel snow in the winter. I'm sorry, folks, but I'm every bit of an Alaskan. And believe me, I will stand up and defend our Constitution and individual liberty and property rights. Please, look at this.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. We appreciate your testimony. And I think, you know, the reason we're hearing this bill today is for the very reasons you state, that we think it is an incredible opportunity for the state. And I hope you'll be able to listen online for a little bit, because we're going to transition into some presentations about access to ag lands. And I think even Representative Tallarico had a bill introduced today about the very topic you just mentioned of getting more Alaskans access to some of the state-owned lands and getting more of those lands into you know, ownership by Alaskans. So I think very timely comments, and I hope you'll stay online for the remainder of our meeting to hear the rest of the presentations. Any questions for Mr. Martin? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Martin, for your testimony. I'm curious about, you mentioned something about limiting licenses to Alaskan residents only. Is this something you're running into? I do know that licenses for marijuana businesses have been limited to Alaskans because the department is trying to keep outside influence out of our local marijuana business. But that's a different kind of business than we're talking about. Can you elaborate, please?
Yes, ma'am. When they pass the regulations for a marijuana growth or sale, there is a requirement in that you're a permanent fund dividend applicant. My wife and I left the state in 2004 after I lost the election against Paul Seaton, by the way, and at 49 years old, never served my country. I've been married 44 years now, folks, just a few days ago. I am every bit Alaskan. I've never been outside the state other than serving my country at a time of war with General Dynamics, rebuilding our training facilities on Oahu and the Big Island. After 3.5 years, I resigned with accommodation from the Department of Defense. I have no desire anymore to live year-round in the state of Alaska. But that makes me no less an Alaskan. Many of you, and in the current law under the Permanent Fund, you're allowed to be outside the state 6 months. Now, I've talked to the Permanent Fund people. They said, yeah, you can go back to 2006. And maybe apply for that. I don't wish to necessarily do that, but to be honest with you, to be barred from entering in commerce in my own state that I've spent all of my adult life in, particularly in private business, to be barred from getting into any business. And that's why you need, and I'm somewhat upset about Mike Chenault introducing some kind of law to do away with the Administrative Regulation Review Committee. You folks should be reviewing those regulations to see how they violate people like my wife and our individual liberty to be in business in our own state. So I'm hoping and praying that maybe I'll get into this in some fashion. But I can tell you folks, my wife and I have earned the ability to move out of the state, which is a U.S. constitutional right, and we pay taxes in both states, Alaska and Hawaii. But I'll tell you something, my heart is in Alaska first, and always will be. So please, do not pass another legislation that bars my wife and I from entering into commerce in our own state.
Thank you for those comments. We have one additional question from Representative Rauscher, and then we want to try and move on. We're going to run a few minutes over, but we want to get to these presentations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank the gentleman on the phone for giving both sides of the aisle equal time in that discussion.
Okay, thank you so much, and thank you for your service to our country. Good points raised. At this time, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on House Bill 172 again. Again, we'll bring that matter back before us in our Monday evening meeting. And I'm going to start on the presentations with Director Keyes and Mr. Eric Johnson from the Division of Ag, who's online. And then we'll transition into Representative Tallarico's presentation with his staff, and hopefully those things will dovetail together. We do have about 15 minutes left, but I'm planning to maybe run over a few more minutes if people can stay, and that way we can have these really good presentations. Director Keyes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Arthur Keyes, Director of Agriculture. For sake of time, I do have a presentation. I will try and move a little bit quicker than maybe I had planned through it.
Okay.
Eric Johnson is going to be online for the Nanana presentation that follows.
Okay, great.
So I want to start off by saying, you know, thank you to the committee for giving me this opportunity. I understand how busy everyone is, and I really do appreciate this. I'd like to start by talking about the positive agriculture activities in Alaska and just a few of them. There's more than this, but we're going to just kind of cruise through these. Farmers market growth in Alaska leads the nation per capita. You know, in 2005, there were 13 markets. Today, there's 42. The peony industry is thriving. With the number of stems being exported exceeding expectations. Grain production is expanding across the state. There's variety trials happening in Delta Junction area as well as the Mat-Su. There's wheat being grown in the Mat-Su right now that is feeding South Central Alaska. One of the bakers that I spoke to said that one of the five wheats that he had tried that was grown in Palmer made some of the best bread he'd ever made. And this is a commercial bakery. Rhodiola and hops are growing in popularity and viability. Hops are an important component in brewing, and this is one of the fastest growing segments in the food industry. Just wanted to point out the value of hops. It's been explained to me that Alaska grown hops can pull $60 to $80 a pound, and with the recent legalization of marijuana, and those are their cousin, they're kind of a cousin plant, and they both have day length issues. That because marijuana has become legalized, some of the greenhouse manufacturers are actually producing greenhouses that will allow a marijuana producer to control the day length, making greenhouse production of marijuana viable with some of the older varieties. Well, that applies to hops. So one of those greenhouses that is designed for marijuana could also produce a dwarf hop that is worth a considerable sum of money to the users. Livestock production is up. McKinley Meat and Sausage had one of the most successful years in recent history, if not ever. At the last BAC, Board of Agriculture and Conservation meeting, I believe that when the accountant presented the numbers, we were $77,000 ahead. And historically, if you followed McKinley Meat and Sausage, this is not the case. So I am cautiously optimistic, saying that it is one of the best years on record for that facility. One of the reasons is because of the number of livestock that's going through that. There's a surge, and it's I think indicative of the positive outlook in agriculture right now in Alaska. My goals and vision for agriculture are going to include some of these following points. I have more than this, but again, we are on a time crunch. I would like to see improved access to ag lands for the beginning farmers. One of the challenges when you're young and you have lots of energy is not having lots of money. And the ag land sales program that we have at the Division of Agriculture, it tries to help those young farmers with that. And myself, my background, I think I've shared with you all that I am an entrepreneur, a farmer, and you know, when I started farming, I was the youngest man in the room, and that is not necessarily the case anymore, which is good because we need young people to come into this. And then in Nana slides, you're going to see a slide presentation on an idea to help young farmers come into the industry. And I'll try and explain that really quick. Historically, some of the ag sale parcels that I have seen that my family participated in the 80s, in the 1980s, would be parcels in size of 160 acres. Or maybe even bigger than that. And there's a clearing requirement for ag parcels that you clear 25% of the farmable soils on that piece of property. And so let's say that it was 100% farmable soil, you'd have a 40-acre clearing requirement. I've cleared land before. That is a huge undertaking. And so what I would like to see, what I would propose, and I've talked to my staff about, is a culture shift in our land sales department and offering up smaller ag pieces that abut larger ag pieces. And the idea would be to move the smaller pieces into the ag community, allowing younger farmers to come into it with a lower burden, lower threshold to reach. Now, these parcels need to have a distance to market. They need to be a whole series of things that we can look at and see financial viability before we sell these parcels. But the idea would be that they would come in, they can develop their farm without developing hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, access the market, make a profit, and when they came back and they said, we have grown the farm and we have reached the bounds of our property, and they can petition the ag land sales at the Division of Agriculture and say, I'm ready for more land, and we will have kept a portion of the abutting land open, that they then would get a preference to expand their farm into that. And these are, in my mind, and what we've discussed is probably 20-acre parcels, and maybe they need to be 10. I'm not sure. There's more discussion that needs to happen. This is not something that will happen overnight. It's in my opinion, a cultural shift that it will take years to see the fruits of this. But that is where I see land sales going. And then the next component that I think is very important is I would like to see the Division of Agriculture help these small farmers enter the wholesale markets. And by those wholesale markets, I mean your Safeway, your Fred Meyer's, possibly Costco's, but I think Safeway and Fred Meyer's is a great place to start. I have personally jumped through those hurdles to get into those and become a vendor for these they're a retail store, but you enter as a wholesale producer. And it is cumbersome, it is frustrating, and I think the Division of Ag has the ability to maybe grease the wheel a little bit and help the farmer connect the dots to get that access. And I think with the farmers markets, the farmers have some great potential to make some instant retail money, and as their operation grows, they would want access to that wholesale market. And then my presentation wouldn't be complete without talking about the important activities that we are currently doing to assist farming in Alaska. The ARLF, the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund, is managed by the Board of Agriculture and Conservation. For those that don't know, McKinley Meat and Sausage is a facility that falls underneath the purview of the ARLF, the Board of Agriculture and Conservation, managed by the Division of Ag. Kind of an interesting situation there. But this loan fund provides loans to farmers. And the best analogy that I've ever heard on this is that a farmer might need to spend $50,000 in the spring to buy fertilizer for his field. And what he's going to do with that $50,000 literally is spread it on the ground, hope it rains, and harvest it in the fall and pay back that loan. And there are farmers that, you know, due to whatever situation, they will borrow every single year for that initial cost of planting. Now, for that farmer to go to a traditional bank and say, hey, I would like $50,000, I'm going to spread it on the ground, and my collateral for you will be the crop that I'm growing. You know, I don't think I need to go into much detail to understand how a traditional banker that's just doing 30-year mortgage loans or auto loans for 7 years is going to think that might just be absurd. The ARLF, with its Board of Agriculture and Conservation, board members who are either farmers or connected to farming in some way, whether it's accounting, small-scale production, large-scale production, greenhouse production, is uniquely suited to overview and look at those applications and make a determination whether or not this farmer's got a plan that works that means that we are going to get our investment back in the fall or whatever whatever scheme is needed. This ARLF currently, if you look at their default rate, it is below, it's been explained to me that it is below the traditional banking standard. The Plant Material Center. Now, this conversation won't be complete without talking about the Plant Material Center. Providing certified, clean, disease-free seed potatoes, grass seed, grain seed. The facility and the work they do, you've heard me, I think everyone here has heard me describe this facility as one of the best kept secrets in Alaska, and I truly believe that. And I think that's important work that must continue if we're to grow this industry. I think the hemp discussions that we're having, I think the PMC will play a critical role in that. And these are two vital things that we are doing. We do more than that, but for the sake of time, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to stop there with that. And to wrap this up, I'm going to tell you that agriculture is growing around the state. I believe localized agriculture will continue to be the trend. I think as long as people are concerned with their health, their families, I think local agriculture has a bright future. But agriculture in Alaska, due to our situation, is a strategic industry. And very quickly, I heard a presentation by Bryce Wrigley yesterday, and he had a great point. When Hurricane Katrina happened, I believe what he said was that it took 2 weeks to get food into that city. They're connected to America. They're right there. They have one of the largest ports in the nation. I heard the numbers of how much food comes through that port, and it's incredible. The idea that people went hungry for 2 weeks, quite frankly, probably, I think people got shot over food for 2 weeks in America. In Alaska, agriculture is strategic. It is so vitally strategic, we cannot forget that. If they went through that in New Orleans, what would we go through in a time of great crisis? So not only is it a strategic issue, it is also an economic, a health, and a community issue. I'm a part of my community. I believe in good health for me and my family, and certainly it's an economic issue. If you run the numbers, that becomes very clear very rapidly. And one thought, and just one last thought to leave you all with, nothing has a greater impact on the quality of a person's life than the food they eat. Thank you.
Thank you. I wish we could go on for 2 hours. It's so exciting. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Director Keyes, you made a statement, you made two statements I want to comment on or at least ask a question about. One was you were talking about farmers and how they almost have to borrow money to purchase their fertilizer every year. Now, I do know that not all farmers, but do you have a percentage on how many are in that economic state that actually have to, you know, go that route every year?
That's a great question. I have spoken passionately about agriculture for over a decade. And in the time that I've spoken, I have built my farm debt-free. And I have advised people that debt-free is a great way to go. It can be done. It's a lot more, I think it's a lot more work, but it's very rewarding at the end of this year. Now, some of the farmers that I know some very smart, some very successful farmers, that borrow every single year, and that is part of their management plan for the farm. And when you say have to, I don't know that you know, not everyone has to, and I think some do. I think it's a resource that needs to be there. I think you'll see a spectrum across the socioeconomic world that borrowing money is a tool.
And I guess the follow-up on that is banks, how receptive or how easy or how hard is that ability for farmers?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I think your question is to borrow money, how easy?
Yeah. I mean, if they're doing it every year, obviously they get credit. So
But how hard is it for them to actually try it with banks to actually work alone for that?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I've heard that it can be very difficult. That's what I've heard through a traditional bank. And currently there are three lending agencies within the state. One is going to be federal government, USDA. One's the state with through ARLF, and then there is a private agriculture. But they all kind of serve different components of the industry. The ARLF plays a very important role in this.
And then finally, last comment through the chair. I apologize, I didn't last time. As you mentioned New Orleans and food that may go in or through there, and it comes there first as it's imported before it's displaced around the country. Same thing with wood. New Orleans, during that Katrina deal, the price of building materials doubled here in the state of Alaska. And when I went to the counter, I said, how can that be? You know, they explained to me that even wood goes through Louisiana before it gets displaced. A lot of it, not all of it. Even a large majority of wood is displaced through Louisiana. And I guess that says a lot about our timber industry and the need for that. Also, here in the state of Alaska, I just wanted to add that comment because I knew Representative from Juneau would say the same.
Representative Westlake, and just quickly, I will comment. You know, if it was easy to get a bank loan for ag lands, I would be out farming, and I would not be sitting here. I can tell you, it's not easy.
Well, it's something I think this committee, and I know it's not comments now. We've got another one, and I thought I was in a hurry, wanted to get it done. Not now. What I do is we became familiar with the term uplifts when we're dealing with mere oil rather than food. Now, if it is the state's land that we're talking about buying, is perhaps something we can talk about off a sidebar, is an uplift when they're starting to buy the next piece of incremental out there and staving off maybe the first two or three years of payment for that land. But it's something I think we should really discuss in the near future. So thank you.
Thank you. Any comments on that?
No.
Okay. Representative Drummond and then Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I so appreciate your enthusiasm, Mr. Keyes. You have talked to us about the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund, and on my desk a couple of weeks ago appeared the annual report of, I believe it's called the Alaska Commercial Agriculture and Fishing Bank. Is that of any assistance at all in this area? Is it duplicative? Is it a totally separate institution? What do you know about it?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, to be quite honest, I don't know much about it. I don't know anything about it. I've heard of it before. I've never had any interaction. I don't know of anybody that has. I can get more information, though, certainly.
Okay, great. That would be helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Parrish, did you have a comment or question?
Oh, just a quick thanks to the director and to my colleague from Sutton.
And before we transition to the other one, to underscore the importance of getting people involved in agriculture, can you tell us currently the average age of an Alaskan farmer?
Thank you, Chair Tarr. I believe it's 57 years old, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So something we can all think about. We talk about the graying of the fleet and fishing, and the same is true in agriculture. And I know frequently I've been the youngest one in the room when these issues I've worked on them over the years. So the new opportunities in getting young farmers, you know, young families to know it can be an economic opportunity. You can raise a family as a farmer. I think that's something we absolutely have to make sure is known and open those doors for folks.
Chair Tarr, if I could say, you know, feeding people is a industry that's in the billions of dollars here in Alaska. There is nothing but opportunity to take those food dollars away from the California farmers or Mexican farmers, or wherever. You know, no offense to them. They do a great job of feeding us. But as a producer and a farmer, I never felt like I was competing. Like I've said this before, I've never felt like I was competing with my neighbor. Or my vendors at the farmers market, someone next to me. I never felt like I was competing with them. I felt like we were complementing each other and going after something that was very vulnerable for us to take away.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions before we transition to this presentation? Okay. Well, I hope, Dr. Keyes, you'll stay there if you have comments. And we have Eric Johnson from the Division of Ag, as well as Wynn Menefee, the Deputy Director for the Trust Land Office, on the phone. And we have Representative Tallarico's staff, Elijah Verhagen. And this is a really exciting presentation. This is about access to ag land, so I'll just briefly say that. Representative Tallarico, did you want to say anything? Or
Madam Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I appreciate Director Keyes being here with us and the folks that are online. And the only thing I want to mention is you guys kind of made 57 sound pretty old. There might be a couple of us here that think that's bad age. So just be a little bit sensitive to us, please. Thank you.
You're the mentors and the knowledge bearers, and we have to come in and learn.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. What I will do, in the interest of time, I will just turn this over to Elijah. I'll be available for any comments. And like I say, once again, we do appreciate Director Keyes being here with us as well. Thank you.
Okay. Elijah, you're up.
All right. Thank you. For the record, my name is Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Dave Tallarico. And again, thank you for having us, Madam Chair. So I'll go as quickly as I can. So this is the Nanatochacket, is how you pronounce that, Bridge to Resources, and then the ag project that we're going to be talking about. And I will defer on a few slides to Director Keyes that he will talk about. So the city of Nenana is located about 45 minutes down the Parks Highway from Fairbanks. I'm going to point real quick. Behind the airport, if you go down the Parks Highway right here, there are actually a lot of farms out in that direction, and then across the bridge, more towards Fairbanks, there are a lot of farms. Nenana isn't currently recognized or talked much about being a farming community like Delta and Palmer are. However, there are many farms there. When I was a kid, I helped bale hay. There's big potato farms there, wheat, peony farms, and then there, as this presentation is going to talk about, there's a lot of potential to grow. Right here is going to be the area we're talking about getting across the Nenana River here and access to all of this ag land way out here. So you guys have all those in your slides as well, so it's a clear picture. And then again, there's a lot of farms are in North Nenana across the bridge right here as well. So this slide here, the Nenana-Tochacket Ag Project has about 133,000 acres. And that starts on the Tochacket right-of-way road that I'll talk about in just a second. It's about 6 miles on that road is the beginning of this 133,000 acres. And then these next four, a few bullet points, I'll turn it over to Director Keyes to talk about.
Are we there already?
Yeah.
All right. That's fantastic. So, you know, Eric Johnson, are you on the line? Eric Johnson?
He should be. Mr. Johnson, are you on the line?
No. Yes, I am.
Okay, I think Director Keyes was trying to get your attention, and so you're on connected.
Madam Chair, if it'd be okay, I'd like Eric Johnson to speak to this slide.
Sure. Mr. Johnson, can you see the slide we're on? It says West Nenana Agricultural Project, and Elijah has just covered the first bullet point. We're on the second bullet point that says the project is composed over 75% Class 4 soils.
I do not have those slides in front of me.
So sorry about that. Okay, Eric?
Yep.
Thank you. I'll just take it from here. You know, this area has an advantage over other agriculture areas, and I'd like to go to this slide and talk about that.
Okay.
So that's the pointer? Yeah. So there's Fairbanks, and there's the project. It's about a 45-minute drive, that's my understanding. And, you know, I talk about an ag plan that a young person can come into. Well, 45-minute drive is financially viable, in my opinion, for a young farmer to start a farm and get to the market. I think if Fairbanks is the market, there's enough people there, there's enough food eaten there on an annual basis that the young farmer accessing that market would financially, they could start a farm. Now, it talked about, in the previous slide, about class 4 soils, and we don't need to go back. Here we go. In the previous slide, it talked about the class 4 soils, and it said 133,000 acres. It's my understanding that there's actually about 100,000 acres of the soil type that we would really be looking to sell that would be potentially viable for an agriculture project. One of the things that's been explained to me is that we would know more, you know, once a farmer goes in there and clears the trees off and find out how it drains and how this soil is going to be. But 100,000 acres, that's a lot of ground. Let's go to the next one.
Rasha, do you have a question?
I didn't mean to interrupt him, but you went to another slide. So the big chunk, the big square that is missing on the right side, who owns that chunk?
Elijah Verhagen, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I'm right about to talk about that, who owns the rest of the land as soon as he's done with his next slide.
Okay.
You're reading his mind. Okay, so now we're on the phased ag project
this
slide.
Is straight, yeah, through the chair. This is a example, just a kind of a my staff and I were brainstorming, and what would it look like? An ag project that a young person would, you know, potentially be able to come in and clear some ground and afford to become a farmer and then have room to expand. What we envision is, you know, the 10 to 20 acre piece up there, that would be your access road. And my staff thought that those two 10 acre chunks on each corner, thought that there would be some wisdom in leaving some ground that's not agriculture, set up for agriculture purposes, that would be more of a development area that you could, you know, there might be a service that the agriculture in the area is going to need, a machine shop, a gas station, you name it. There's going to be services needed, and keeping a few critical pieces open for that would service the rest of the agriculture project. And so this is kind of what we are talking about. The access road would come in, sell the 20-acre parcels, and then they could expand into the 40-acre parcels as they succeeded. And I will point out, too, you know, there's 20-acre parcels there. I think you could sell all those, and I think people would come into them thinking, I'm going to farm this. But I think, like with anything, I think you're not going to have 100% success. But I think you would have some success, and that's what you would encourage after a few years, and just keep that success growing. So, Elijah, that's turned over to you now.
Any questions on that? Okay.
All right. For the record, again, Elijah Verhagen. And just to comment on that, there has been a lot of people that are excited and wanting to be able to access this land. I'm actually from Nenana, born and raised, and yes, there's a lot of excitement about getting over to this land. I also know a farmer that's relocated here from Idaho because the market's better to sell potatoes here, and so he's moved to Nenana, bought an existing farm, and is now farming potatoes in his third year, and loving it. And so there's a lot of excitement. He's actually under 57 and brought a bunch of his big scale equipment from Idaho up here.
Representative Rauscher, did you have a question?
So what are the stipulations,
through the chair, what are the stipulations that you envision here on length of ownership before you could sell? Coming from living through the history of the Point McKenzie Ag Project and others?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher.
Can you buy it and resell it tomorrow? Can somebody buy all of the 80s up? And, you know, I, after they're all purchased, how does this work?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher. Certainly, my intent would be to sell these smaller parcels first and keep the 40s and the 80s, hold them back. Don't put them up for sale. And certainly, farmers can sell. They can sell their farm. There's no restrictions on that. But when they purchase an ag land, they're agreeing to fill out and present the Division of Agriculture with a farm plan. They're going to fill it out, put it before us, and whatnot. If they want to move and sell out, they're not indentured to the land.
but the next owner is going to be under the same stipulations that they were under, and he's going to need to fill out a agree to that farm, to fill out a farm plan and do that. Could he buy them all up? Yeah, certainly one person certainly could. I would expect that they would purchase them to farm them, because they're not going to be able to develop them for. I mean, it's not a resort investment.
I guess one person could actually own every one of the 30 there.
Certainly, and I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Okay.
If they could farm it all, I would, more power to them. Absolutely, and through the chair, Representative Rauscher, we have sold pieces of land that are 300 acres at a time, and we're not even talking 600 acres. We've sold some very large tracts of farm ground. I think you have some farmers in Delta Junction who own thousands of acres. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's why I'm figuring. So this is just, through the chair, this is just if you wanted to subdivide an envisionment. Otherwise, you could just sell it a 360-acre chunk.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher. Yeah, historically, from what I've seen, it looks like, and I don't think this is the entire ag sales goes like this. I think we need to offer some pieces like this for the young people. I think there will still be, as Elijah has said, I still think there will be people that want 300 acres or 600 acres. I'm not opposed to that at all. But I don't think a 25-year-old young person that wants to get into farming can afford to buy a 160-acre piece of property, buy the equipment necessary to clear it, buy a farm tractor to farm it, and build the infrastructure necessary to be a successful producer, and do all that without taking on massive debt. And I was very fortunate, like I said earlier, about how I built my farm. I built it with my back. And I think that debt is okay used properly. And I think going into debt to put a 20-acre piece of ground into production is a lot wiser than getting 200 acres and going into debt.
And through the chair, I wasn't speaking for or against. I was just trying to understand what we're doing.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. So the next slide, we're going to talk about briefly about the other people that own land, landowners across the river. And like that first bullet is pointing out there, the interest in this project has been basically everyone who has talked about this is very enthusiastic about it. We right here, it shows that some of the landowners over there, besides the state, and the state actually, once this bridge is complete, there will be available. It'll open up to over 600,000 state acres, 133,000 of which are the designated ag land in that picture. Then next we have the Tagatili Native Corporation, which is the local corporation there in Inanna, and they own 40,000 acres. Alaska Mental Health Trust land, which they again are on the line for the end, they have 11,000 acres and are very excited about this. And University of Alaska has 640 acres. We have over 8 letters of support from various entities that are all, again, very excited about this that we've been using and submitted in CAPSIS, etc. So right here, this next slide shows the landowners. So there's the little key right here of who owns what. So to answer your question, Representative Rauscher, earlier, this big chunk right here is the Tagatili Native Corporation, and in partnership with Doyon, who owns the mineral rights. And so all of that yellow, it looks like it's yellow, it's kind of hard to see, but all of that land right here, as the key is showing right here, is Tagatili and Doyon land. Then the pink is the 11,000 acres of the Mental Health Trust land. The university has those two little 320-acre lots right there. And then this whole section right here is the ag project we're talking about, right in the middle of the right-of-way. And then we have the state Tanana State Forest right up here, and then right here the Minto Flat State Game Refuge. So again, this is that 600,000 available acres right here by the right-of-way that I'll talk about in just a second. You could see on your, probably better on your slides, but there's that, the end of the finished road is right there, is mile 15. So once the bridge is built, we'll have instant access to the beginning part of the ag land, and then of course they could start selling off some of that stuff as the road is extended on the right of way. So this is what the existing road looks like. I was just out there this last fall, and my brother took this picture. Beautiful, beautiful land out there. Really exciting. So the only problem, of course, is to get to that land is the Nenantochacket Bridge project, which, again, you guys can see in your slides here, but this is an aerial view. Here's existing pilings right here, and the already built Little Nenana Bridge that was part of the project. This is a big boat launch. It's full every fall. A lot of hunters that go all the way up all the rivers and everything. But, yeah, so this bridge is already done right here, and then I'll show you in just a second that there's the remaining materials and everything are just sitting right down the road here to span the rest of it. So here's another side angle. You can see the finished portion of the little bridge. And then this is right over here are all the girders remaining to span the big span. And all the remaining materials are just right there on site. They've been there for a couple years, and we don't want them to rust away. Right here, most of the pilings are driven. This one they had to actually stop in the middle of it because they've been doing this in the winter, and we've had two really, until this year, 50 below, but we've had two very warm winters for the interior the past previous years, one of which, the beginning, I think, was when they were pounding this down. The ice started to give way, and so they quickly retreated, as they should, and they were not able to finish that piling. So once that's pounded down, they have one more additional piling right there to finish. There's our mayor, Mayor Mayrand, who's headed up this project and done a really great job. Jumped through hurdle after hurdle, standing next to all the remaining materials that need to go up. So you guys have this in your slide, so I won't take a ton of time, but this is just a few bullets of the brief history of the project. It started in the 80s. We got the right of way by DNR in 1984. In 2008, 2009, 11 miles of the road and the three smaller bridges over small creeks were built and completed out there. They got all the required NEPA documents and got a permit from Army Corps of Engineers and turned in for a permit for the Coast Guard. And then they had partial funding, a little over $6 million to do what they've done so far. For the bridge specifically, and then they got a grant of $3 million to extend the road, which they did and extended about 4 miles to where it's total about 15 miles now. But they had to do that in the winter, which was very expensive. And then, these kind of just a summary. It's great potential for our whole state. We have a lot of people excited. The governor's been working with us as well, and I'm going to talk about that on the last slide. Doyon, TCC, Nenana Native Council, lots of mental health, all have sent in letters of support. With completion of this bridge, it'll provide instant access to all of this land. Which will then be available for all sorts of things, including Representative Rauscher's point about maybe the need for more wood in a disaster. There's a lot of timber potential out there as well. And final slide, where we are at. The city of Nenana has filed everything, turned in the environmental assessment, and they've been waiting for a long time for the bridge permit. The governor and the DNR commissioner have talked to the admiral here in Juneau, and they said that they will get us the remaining permit in June, and we are right now looking for remaining funds. And with that's the completion of the project.
Thank you, Mr. Verhagen. And did you want Mr. Menefee to add anything in? Was there?
He was online to answer any questions about the Mental Health Trust. They have 11,000 acres over there. They're really excited about this as well. If he has any comments, he can say them now. But, yeah.
Okay. Mr. Menefee, did you want to add anything?
This is Mr. Menefee. This is Wynn Menefee, Deputy Director of the Trust Land Office. And not to delay anything, but I would say that we are supportive of having a bridge because it opens up our lands for oil and gas, coal bed methane, timber harvest, and land sales. So we see that making revenue off of these lands over here would be improved by having a bridge, and that would be beneficial to the beneficiaries of the trust. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Menefee? Okay. So for Representative Tallarico or Mr. Verhagen, when we had talked about this a little bit earlier, I guess the status of the permit was, it sounds like that maybe has resolved itself a little bit, because it seems like the status of the permit, that's been a hold up here with getting the rest of the bridge completed, has been this remaining Coast Guard permit. But do you feel comfortable that that's been resolved? Because one of the ideas that Representative Tallarico and I had was perhaps the Resources Committee could send a letter of support and, you know, in support of getting access to these ag lands. And so do you still feel like that could be something beneficial?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for asking that question. I think that would be beneficial. I'm feeling pretty comfortable that we're kind of on the right direction for the permit. And, you know, where we've really gone is we've provided all of this information to our congressional delegation, because there's money involved to get the rest of the bridge up. And, of course, we've heard a lot about there's going to be funding available for infrastructure projects and things like that. And I hate the term shovel-ready anymore, because, you know, that was overused for years and years and years, and people talked about shovel-ready, and you saw shovel-ready projects that had no value to them whatsoever. They were just shovel-ready, which doesn't necessarily mean they're good. It just means you can build them. This one, I think, and the interest seems to be, in particularly from a congressional delegation, there's a benefit for the state of Alaska. Obviously, the Mental Health Land Trust has a benefit. The university has a benefit in this. Our local village corporation has a benefit in this, and the Native Corporation Doyon, as well as what we've talked about, and Mr. Keyes has pointed out, fresh food versus ship food, 45 minutes from Fairbanks, where there's about 100,000 people in the North Star borough, and of course it's a hub, and it's the hub for communities in my district in District 6. And Representative Westlake's district in District 40, we get so much stuff out of there spread out into that shared border that we have in all those northern communities. So we have generated some interest. I think we've a little bit of excitement with our congressional delegation, which is, I think, is likely where we have to go to get this finished. And I think the possibility, if we could discuss it with a committee later, a committee letter to add to that would be great. I, for all those listening, I really appreciate the Division of Ag support, Mental Health Trust Authority, University of Alaska, Doyon, Tagatili, local farmers. It's been kind of phenomenal. And we do, I think, one thing that I would like to stress is there are some successful local farm. It's not known as a farming area. There's actually a U-Pick farm in Nenana now that runs all summer, where people go down. They have you come on and pick your own vegetables. So people from the Healy area are coming down. People from Fairbanks are coming down, and they pick fresh vegetables from this place and go. It's also got one of the more successful tree farms in the state of Alaska. And there are places where you may drive along the new Seward Highway, where they've recently done, in the last couple of years, where they've done some landscape architectural stuff, and you might see a birch tree or an aspen or something like that, likely came from the tree farm in Nenana. So it's I don't want to say it's the untouched agriculture hotspot in the state, but I'm very excited because the 100,000 potential acres, and Madam Chair, if you'll give me the liberty, I will attach this a little bit to the bill that got read across today. We talk about young people, and my idea on the bill isn't so much for a guy my age. I hate to get into this age thing. But we have a lot of young people that actually qualify for a permanent fund dividend. Mm-hmm. And what an opportunity maybe to connect this with a permanent fund dividend and allow them to commit their permanent fund dividend to mm-hmm. buy a piece of land mm-hmm. and create a business, mm-hmm. entrepreneurial mm-hmm. thing. So if we can tie that together, I'm very excited about it. I think it's an incredibly valuable piece of property, and I think it provides benefits for us in several different areas. So, Thank you. Boy, I sure turned that into a long answer, didn't I?
No, that was excellent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Of course. It was a great presentation. Mr. Verhagen, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, one more thing real quick, and also to add on that, Nenana has been known for a long time as a hub for transportation. We have the railroad that goes right through there, and therefore we could put stuff on the train and get it down to Anchorage and other markets as well, fairly easy. Also, there's three barge lines in Nenana, and they ship to all the rural villages on the Tanana. They go up the Yukon. They go all over the place, as well as the Parks Highway, which is the main artery between the rail belt. So, yeah.
Thank you. That was great to add. I'm very interested in the Resources Committee writing a letter of support for this project and submitting that to our congressional delegation as well as any other, you know, interested parties, the U.S. Coast Guard and others. So what I would want to do with permission from the committee and, of course, checking in with the members who are not with us at this time is, you know, ask Representative Tallarico's office and his staff to draft something for our consideration and then, you know, weigh in, get feedback from members, and then, you know, speak in unison in support of this, getting access to these lands that would provide all those new opportunities. Representative Parrish, did you have a comment on that?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. If the bridge can be financed with federal monies or private monies, well, bless you. Well done. Carry on. is that currently the plan?
Well, we're hoping, you know, I'm sorry, through the chair. Thank you. We are really hoping that somehow or another we will get that kind of support in an effort from them to help us step forward. We don't know. I guess we'd be one of those groups of people, as we look at it, we'd probably take money from anybody for the year. Somebody's writing a check, let us know. One of the things where I think the interest really is, and this might be hard for, well, it shouldn't be hard for me to explain, one of the most resilient communities on the face of the planet is Nenana, which has gone through Tanana River floods and been through big changes and didn't used to have a road and everything. Nenana is one of our oldest cities in the state, and I'll put a plug in for the folks in Nenana. Mm-hmm. They're not just resilient. They're a great group of people. There's probably enough people around there. There are some young people in that area that could turn into a farming workforce that could make this go. We talked about the land clearing. There are great white spruce timber resources over there to get that land cleared before you even start to farm. I mean, it's enormous. There's local sawmills that will use those products. So it's got great potential.
Great. Wonderful. We want to wrap up here shortly. Representative Parrish, do you have any other comments?
Yes, I'd like to ask, what can you tell me about the two exploratory wells in that area?
Boy, I don't know a lot about. I know they've put. Mr. Verhagen probably knows more about those than I do.
Again, for the record, Elijah Verhagen. Through the chair, Representative Parrish, the Doyon has been drilling for oil and gas out there for years, and they mostly on their land, and then they're leasing some state land right now, and they are very excited and invested in this. They've actually built 11 miles of the road with their own money. You know, haven't asked for that, and they've put their own money into it, lots of money, built the three smaller bridges, and because of the potential for oil and gas out there, which, again, very close to the market, a lot closer than the North Slope. And so they're very excited for this to move forward. They go across they build ice bridges every year, and they've drilled three wells. So far, they found caves, which is, you know, emptied wells, and so they know it's there, but they're still investing a lot because they believe they're gonna find what they're looking for. So, yeah.
And if I could add one thing to that, something that's always critical to agriculture, water resources.
Mm-hmm.
This has great water and lots of water resource there.
Mm-hmm.
And my interest, of course, is Tochack and Slough. The road would get all the way out to the Slough and gets to the edge of the Slough, and there's 2 and 3 foot long northern pike in that slough. So, I'm interested in that.
Okay, before retirement, we'll get you out there, Representative Tallarico. Well, at this time, unless there's an objection, I'd like to ask Representative Tallarico and his staff to draft something for the committee's consideration, and then we'll bring that before the committee and take a look and then make our next move. Okay, thank you for your presentation. Director Keyes, thank you for being in Juneau again for our first annual Ag Week in the Resources Committee, because this is something that can get us all really excited, and it's been great to have you here. Thank you for your time. At 4:34, we are adjourned.